You guys are hysterical watching you watch a video from up here. I just want you to know that. My name is Matt, and I am the lead pastor at Watershed. Welcome to the first weekend of this series. I want to begin this series and this morning with a question. And the question is this: why are you here? Why are you here? You could have been anywhere this morning, right? You could have stayed home. You could have slept in. You could have gone for a walk, gone for a hike. Could have cleaned your house, cut the lawn. You could have binge-watched that Netflix series you've been waiting to binge-watch, finished a book, walked your dog, washed the car, balanced your checkbook, went to the gym, gone to yoga. But you didn't. You came here. Why? Why are you here? Why does Garrett Boyd, where are you at, Garrett? Shoot a hand up. Thank you, Garrett. Why does Garrett drive almost 40 minutes from Statesville? Why do the plants drive almost 40 minutes from Midland? The painters, 40 minutes from Denver. The Kings, 40 minutes from Kannapolis. Why does Brittany and Rustin Terry drive 54 minutes from Clover, South Carolina? Wow. And not only this, they have to drive through Booger Town to get here. The only family allowed to complain about coming to Watershed is the Terry family moving forward, because they have to drive through Booger Town to get here. I'm teasing. I'm sure Booger Town is wonderful. If you have family and friends in Booger Town, it's okay. I'm just picking. I'm just getting started. I am a world-class dad jokester. It's gonna, you just hang on to your hat. Why do they do this? Why do you do this? Why did you inconvenience yourself today? What compelled you to go through the trouble of leaving your home to make your way here today? Why are you here? Well, we started trying to answer this question a few months ago as a staff. We sat in front of this whiteboard, and we began to recount and recall all the different conversations we've been a part of with you, whether that's in reclamation or preface or on a Sunday or in greenhouse or student ministries. And it's like this board started to fill up, and it grew like 20 different reasons all over the map in some instance. And then we started to try to distill down, well, what's the undercurrent here? Like if you had to drill it down to one overarching reason, what would it be? And the more we looked at this, the more we reflected on it, hope became the reason. At some level, you're here because there's at least a mustard seed size hope that pulls you towards this space. And so for the next 4 weeks, we're going to explore this idea a little bit. We're going to spend talking about how hope is central to why someone would choose community. We're going to talk about how community can animate hope, how reclamation can instill hope, and how hope collectively invites us into something. And so that's kind of what you're in store for the next several weeks. And I want to begin this morning by saying that hope can be complicated as an idea. I think it's a lot like some of the other ethereal language that we throw around, like we throw at each other when we really don't know what to say, when things are difficult or things are struggling. And it actually, you can create more harm than good with it sometimes, you know? Especially if someone is really in a tough spot. You just got to have hope. Don't lose hope. You know, hang on to hope. Things will work out. Things always work out. You're overreacting. Don't ever say that to somebody. You're overreacting. Sometimes we use verses from the Bible, right? Like we're conditioned to throw these platitudes towards people. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. All things work together for the good of those who love God, who are called according to God's purpose. Just have hope. Now, I want to say that there's nothing inherently wrong with anything I just said. There's nothing morally wrong. In fact, not only have I used that type of verbiage. I've received it. And at times it's actually felt good. It's been encouraging. Having said that, though, sometimes things don't work out. Sometimes the worst happens. Sometimes the story doesn't end well. Sometimes we hope for something, it never arrives. Sometimes we hope for something, it arrives, and we're thinking, why in the world were we ever hoping that would arrive? Anytime language is used as sort of this incantation or some sort of antibiotic to whatever painful situation is in front of you or someone else, if you're not careful, you can unintentionally dismiss your own pain or the real pain of others that are experiencing something difficult. I think this can be especially true for marginalized communities, oppressed communities. One of my favorite author theologians, you've heard me say this before, is Miguel de la Torre. And de la Torre describes hope as sometimes a control mechanism for the masses, a way of domestication for people who are in oppressive situations. He says, hope works very well when you are among the conquerors. Hope is like this carrot that gets dangled out in front of a group of people who are struggling with everything they could, not just to find a way for themselves, but find a way for themselves together. And so hope, this carrot of like, well, if you just work a little harder, if you just fall in line, if you just remain patient, if you have a calm and civil discourse and dialogue, well, then things will get better. Really, we want to work with you to get things better. There's this injustice will start to be eradicated and systems will be dismantled. Heaven will finally come to earth. Maybe. But will it? Will it ever fully materialize when you're talking about oppressive systems and people who are marginalized by systems designated for self-preservation for the wealthy and the powerful at the expense of the poor and the powerless? Hope is complicated, right? I think hope is complex too. And this is a little different path that I want to talk about this morning, so hang with me here. Our default way of showing up to reality is often through a lens of separation. Like somehow we are our own entity, our own autonomous presence, and we're just experiencing the external world as though nothing is really going on beyond just what we observe or describe. There's one of my favorite movies is Moneyball, and there's this scene where the Peter Brand character, played by Jonah Hill, is describing a new way of understanding how to put teams together. And he's telling this to the Oakland A's GM, Billy Beane, played by Brad Pitt. And he says this, he says, listen, there is an epidemic failure within the game to understand what is really happening. And I think that's kind of true when we talk about how hope gets animated and how something gets generated out of nothing. This is a picture of me at Food Lion standing in front of a freezer section in front of a box of White Castles. I grew up on White Castles. White Castles are what I describe as disgustingly delicious or deliciously disgusting. You choose. I don't know how to say it any other way. But we would go to White Castle restaurants when I was in college at like 1 a.m. in the morning after the bars closed because it was cheap and you could get a lot of it. And so my friends would pile on these things back in those days. I thoroughly enjoyed them and I still do, much to the chagrin of my wife, who's like, you can't ride with me in the same car if you're going to eat those. But it's odd to walk into a Food Lion in Charlotte, North Carolina and see these because you have to drive like 5 or 6 hours to get White Castles. And so it feels random at some level. But it's really not. It's not because when I go to the frozen food section and I pick up a box of White Castles and I check out, there's an ecosystem that is involved in that entire process. I am communicating something and something is listening. I am one of a vast array of sophisticated elements that create that system, the system of Food Lion, that then also ends up putting more White Castle cheeseburgers on the shelf. And I don't hold all of that power by myself. I'm not buying that many White Castles. Some of you are like, that dude buys a lot of White Castles. They're in stores all over North Carolina. No, it's there's a community or a group of people that are parts that are playing a role within the context of the whole. And it informs how that entity known as Food Lion functions. And I'm not just one part of the entity. There's cashiers, there's delivery drivers, there's people who stock the shelves, there's farmers and factory workers and accountants and people who do marketing and CEOs and banks. There's a whole flurry of stuff that makes up the whole of Food Lion. If I or everyone else stopped going to Food Lion would cease to exist. If we all just stopped buying White Castles, then White Castles would no longer be on the shelf. And I'm describing an organism per se, a system that is interacting with me, not as separate, even though it feels that way when I walk through the sliding glass doors. It's a whole system, a whole ecosystem that is in and of itself communicating to me. I am communicating to it. I am changing it by the way that I participate, by the way I show up and have presence. And it is changing me, although not in the best, healthiest ways once I eat the White Castle. You can apply the same logic to traffic, right? We talk like traffic is something that we don't create while we're in it. This traffic is awful. If everyone would just get off the roads, but we are the traffic. We are as much a part of the problem as we're a part of the problem, and we act like we're not. We have special status and all that as being separate. Same thing could be true for like the internet. Every time you click, every time you and I share, every time we download something, there's something listening, right? In a disturbing fashion, if you watch any Netflix documentaries. Something is listening, something is adjusting itself and spitting back to you the thing that it thinks that you want to be hearing, the thing that you want to engage in. And so we're never having our own experience. We're never really separate. We're actually a part of a greater whole, informing, being informed, changing and being changed in the process. This is true with relationships and community as well. If you are a part of a relationship, if you're in a relationship, and this person tells the same story every time you're together, and you're like, dear God in heaven, are they always going to share this story? And you just let them do it. Well, the way your presence is being placed in that situation, you're continuing to give that permission. So you're creating the environment that in the end is frustrating you. But there's a symbiosis that's taking place in that. The same thing is true for community. Your time, your energy, your resources is a part of this symbiotic relationship between all the parts within the context of the whole that makes up that relationship. Now, it's interesting. There's these two stories in the scriptures, and as I was thinking about all of this, they sort of surfaced for me, and I thought, I think we're seeing a little bit of that sort of show up in the pages of these stories that these ancient writers were trying to describe. So the first one, you're probably familiar with it. It's the rich young ruler, right? Like this wealthy, powerful young Israelite guy shows up to Jesus and says, hey, what do I need to do to inherit the kingdom of heaven? What must I do to inherit the very best life that God offers? That's the simple translation. And you remember Jesus' response. Sell all of your possessions, give the proceeds, the money to the poor, and then come follow me. And he's not describing like just start believing different things. He's like, no, literally, come with me. And where would he have gone? Into his community, right? Into his group, in with his disciples. And so this man contemplates about this, but it's a bridge too far. Instead of connection and community, he chooses separation and isolation, disconnects, and the outcome is he walks away sad. Now, interesting enough, a little bit later, another story in the book of Acts is told where this same phrase about possessions being sold surfaces again. That's interesting. But this time, in this story, there's a group of people who are in duress. There are people who are suffering the constant threat of persecution and poverty and crucifixion and enslavement. They're in crisis and they're just trying to figure out, how do we how do we hang on in a world that seems like it's built against us? What does it mean to have safety and shelter and food and our needs to be cared for? And instead of making the decision to separate, this group makes the decision to come together. And it says all the believers were together and had everything in common. Instead of holding on to the thing that creates the obstruction for connection, they let go. And they sell property and possessions, and they give to anyone who had need. Now, do you see the juxtaposition here, the comparison? In the first story, invitation into the whole as a part is rejected, separation is chosen, despair, the outcome. In the second story, separation is rejected, and interdependence, collaboration, shared responsibility, engagement, collectivity are chosen. And instead of despair, you see a completely different, like, inspiring picture. And the author says that every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. There was something completely different at play in the decision to see themselves as part of something and to be a part of something, to engage and push their chips to the middle of the table, so to speak. And simply put, in the second story, the engagement with one another animated life and animated hope. It took Watershed almost 15 years to write its mission statement. You know, we like to pace ourselves here, apparently. Every time we thought we had it nailed down, like, ah, that's it, something would happen. Some new idea would surface. Some experience would happen. We would become aware or awake to something. And we're like, oh, wow, okay, wait a minute. I don't think that language fits. Because now we have to edit. Now we have to go through adjustment and implementation and new learning. And within all of our flawed humanity here, within all of our imperfections, I often describe Watershed as a beautiful mess. Within the beautiful mess, in spite of all this, each time it happened, it felt like we would click towards becoming more of our most authentic self as a church. Again, work in progress and with all of its flaws. More true to ourselves, more true to the way we wished the world existed, more true to the way that we think, we speculate that Jesus would long for the world to exist. And what happened was, as we started to realize that who we were was really bound up in the process of becoming. Hence, our language, our lexicon, so to speak, began to mimic this process of becoming. Our mission statement became the language of becoming. Watershed is a community awakening, struggling, and loving together as though a different world is possible. And this is the best, the closest language we come to being able to articulate who are we. Who are we as a church? And I wanted to name this on the front side of this series because while hope is complicated and complex, if you had to distill this process down to one animating notion, if you had to distill it to the collectivity that mirrors 20 reasons on a whiteboard in an office in the various iterations of ourself, as well as this statement, again, the animating notion is hope. It's hope. And so here's the thing. Part of what we're going after in this series is not just good information or good stories. We're actually going to ask something of you every week when you show up here. We're attempting to say, how do you like press hope into the DNA of a community? What are the practical ways of doing this? We're going to make an audacious statement of asking something from you in ways at times that we've never had the audacity to ask. But we're trusting that you're starting to see, or you will start to see, that you're not separate. Like you're a part of this. That as you are here, you are informing this community. This community is informing you. You are changing it, and it is changing you. And you are a part of this symbiotic relationship that exists between ideas and emotions and structures and outcomes and opportunities and people here in this community. And so we're going to get started really slow and small this morning because I don't want to freak anybody out about what we're inviting you to do. And I think probably when you hear me say these, you're going to be like, oh, okay, that's kind of like no-brainer stuff. But let's get started and let's go small first. All right, here's the first thing. Would you come more? Will you be here more? Like, some of you come once a month, can you come twice? Some of you come twice, can you come three times? Some of you serve twice, but you don't come for a third time. And you rob Watershed of something when you're not here. Because we're trusting that your presence is creating something within the larger ecosystem of who we are. Will you come earlier? Like, our band is working really hard to shut things down at 9:30. There's coffee in the back. Will you stay longer? Will you linger? If you've noticed, we've been actually programming that in after our Sunday gatherings. That's because we're leading up to this conversation. If you have kids, go get your kids and come back in here. And it's okay if they're running crazy. In my Baptist days, man, that was a sign of the presence of God, you know? It's all right. Keep them off the stage, all right? But like, can you be here more? We're trusting that in the organic space that we create, as relationships begin to form, as that interactivity, as that beautiful chaos starts to happen, hope will begin to emerge in that process. Will you come more? Will you make it a point to introduce yourself to someone you've never met every time you're here? Isn't that audacious? Hey, how you doing? My name's Matt. I've been here for a while. How long have you been here? Is this your first Sunday? It's so embarrassing when I ask that and they say, Matt, I've been here 10 years. I'm like, well, that's embarrassing. It's not that extreme. It's not that extreme. Expressing curiosity is a way of acknowledging someone. And it's a way of getting started in the relational process. Hospitality is the responsibility of everybody. And if you live with a view of separation, then you think that we have a hospitality team to do that. And we do have a hospitality team. But it's everyone's ilk to be curious and to connect and to say, I'm interested in knowing you and I would love for you to know me. Will you make it a point to introduce yourself? Will you make it a point to get to know at least one person? That's a little further, right? I know David mentioned preface and reclamation and these liberation experiences, regional collectives. Blair's going to talk a little bit about that next week. But these are all spaces that we're creating for that to actually take place, and you don't need that, of course. If you see the same person three or four times on a Sunday that you've introduced yourself to, chances are you're going to start to get to know them if you keep engaging them, if you continue to engage them. I saw someone here this morning who went through preface when we were in the other building. And she went through preface, and then life kind of took her in a different direction. I saw her this morning. I'm like, oh, my gosh. She's back. And I couldn't wait to talk to this person because we got to know each other over the course of a few weeks. Will you take some time to get to know one another? And if you're, you know, if you're an introvert, I know that's tough, right? But I think all of you introverts probably sit in the same quarter. Just get to know each other back there, all right? Just, you know, do what you can, right? I'm sorry, bad pastor. And I know every single one of you are going to do this, right? Right? Okay, at the outside chance that this feels really hard and you just need a little more of a motivation to come more, introduce yourself, and to get to know someone, the outside chance, I want to share a quick story, or a story. I don't know how quick it'll be. This is a photograph of two friends of mine, Blair Miller and Jonathan Bobbitt Miller, who started coming to Watershed in, I think, around 2006. I want to say right around our first anniversary when we were uptown in Actors Theater. Jonathan and Blair had been together, been in a partnership, I think, for about 5 years. And man, They just fell in love with Watershed. Watershed fell in love with them, and it was like a glass slipper fit. What they didn't know initially was that this was before we were fully affirming and fully accepting of the gay community. And I think it was about 4 months later when we did a series on relationships and sexuality where that became very clear. And there was a bit of pain, a bit of disruption. And so we started to work with each other at some level. We started spending time with each other, and we became friends. My family and their family, our staff, so many in the community. And this went on for several years, and we just figured out a way to kind of hold the tension around all of this. I want to remind you, this is when only 3 states in the United States would legally marry same-sex couples. So this is in some ways, it feels like prehistoric times past, right? But we held this tension as best that we could. They did a killer job of doing that. And then I think about 3 or 4 years into it, I got an email from Blair. It said, hey, can we grab lunch? And I remember sitting across the table from him at Owens Bagels on South Boulevard and him saying, hey, listen, I know that North Carolina doesn't marry people, but my relationship with Jonathan, our relationship together has become so deepened over the last couple of years, in part by this community. Like, we love each other in a way that is so different than we did when we first started coming here. We want to get married. I know you and Scott have started to shift a little bit. Would you be willing to do the ceremony, one of you? And he said, oh, by the way, it's 18 months away, so you got some time to figure it out. And so we did. We took some time, and we went and talked to our staff, and we talked to our leadership, our elders at the time. And we were trying to ask the question, is this possible? Are we in a place to be able to do it? While this was all going on, I was wrestling. Because while I had moved from a very black and white way of understanding all of this to a very ambiguous way, my heart had already arrived. Hadn't worked it all out in my head, but it's like, I don't want to ever have to say no to this again, but I don't know how our community is going to respond. God, what should I do? Like, God, give me a sign. And it was about this time that Jonathan, who's a local EMT, was a local EMT at the time, had scheduled to go on a medical missions trip to Guatemala with a group from Watershed. And a week before he left, he was on a run. They picked up a mother who was struggling to give birth, and the baby was breech. And so on the way into the hospital, the ER, the ER doctor coached Jonathan on how to do the procedure where you turn the child in the womb. And so he does this in the ambulance, saves the mom, saves the child. What a great story, right? About a week later, he's with this team in Guatemala. They're doing this medical clinic sort of deal in the village. And one afternoon as they're driving through the village, this little boy comes out of one of the little houses that you can see there in the background and stops the Jeep, says, please, my mom is giving birth. There's a problem. Please help her. And so the team rushes into this little house shack sort of thing. Sure enough, mom's breech. Baby's breech, rather. And so this is a picture of Jonathan and this team carrying this mom out of her home to put into a vehicle to take down this hill and to a clinic where Jonathan performs this same procedure, saves the mom, saves the child's life. About 18 months later, I go back to the same village. It was a ministry partner at the time. This is a picture of me with the mom, and this is the son whose actions of Jonathan saved this little boy, and whose name is Juan, which is John or Jonathan in Spanish, because of course you name your son after the person that saved his life. The whole time, God, are these people worthy? Seriously? They're saving lives in a foreign country. How ridiculous does it sound 10 years later? And it sounded really ridiculous then. If there was ever, there's probably like 4 or 5 moments where something really shifted for me. This might have been the coup de grace. Fast forward a few months later, We're probably about 6 months away from the wedding. And I wish I could tell you that Watershed's response was courageous, but it wasn't. We said no. We said, I'm sorry, guys, we can't do this. Our community thinks we're someplace completely different than Scott and I are, or that some of our other community are. But here's what came out of that experience. They should have never stayed, but they did. They turned back towards the community and all their grief and all their pain. And in so doing, Watershed made a commitment. I will never say no again. And we were officially, intentionally in the process of figuring out what it means to become fully affirming and fully accepting of this community. Probably the most significant inflection point of this community's history. Jonathan and Blair, they moved to like I think the Boston area a year or so later after that event, and they now live in D.C. This is actually a picture of them. They're two world-class dads. I think there's a photograph. Yeah, that's their family. Two world-class dads to Zeke and Jameson and Cash, and there's a whole beautiful story about one of their sons in the adoption process, including a family here at Watershed that I don't have time to share. But they've been married for 10 years, and maybe you figured this out. But they're here this morning. So guys, would you stand up? Where are you at? Yeah, stand up. Don't sit down because I'm not done. I didn't tell them I was going to do this because I don't think they would have showed up this morning. This is long overdue. I know you've received private apologies for what you went through, but you deserve a public apology. So on behalf of this community, we're so sorry for what you went through. And also on behalf of this community, I don't have words for how grateful this your practiced courage and your audacious hope. There were seasons during that time in our history where you believed this community could be something that I'm not sure I could believe myself. And so from the bottom of our hearts, we want to say thank you. And then this too, if you're a part of our Kindred community, would you please stand? If you are a parent of a child who is in the LGBTQ plus community, would you stand? If you're here because you couldn't stomach one more day in a place that refused to love the people you love, and you're here because you're an ally, would you stand this morning? This is your legacy right here. This is your legacy. This is what hope looks like. It's 10 years later, but it's worth every tear, every ounce of sacrifice, every apology, every celebration, every minute. This is what it looks like as a community awakening, struggling, and loving as though a different world is possible today.